This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll hear from climate scientist and Nobel Peace Prize winner Richard Alley. He speaks next week at Albion College. But first, passenger pigeons once outnumbered all other birds in North America. They migrated in flocks that sometimes included a billion or more individuals. But aggressive hunting over just a few decades in the 19th century caused their numbers to plummet. And 100 years ago this September, they disappeared altogether when the last known passenger pigeon died at the Cincinnati Zoo. Author and naturalist Joel Greenberg explains how the population went from billions to none in just 50 years in his new book, A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction.
It's a cautionary tale to the proposition that no matter how abundant something is, be it fuel, water, or something alive, if we're not good stewards, we can lose it.
Greenberg will discuss his research at the Kalamazoo Audubon Society on April 28th. He spoke with WMUK's Sevilla Man about the role the 19th century's high technologies played in the pigeons' destruction and how their loss contributed to modern conservation.
Let's talk a little bit more about the pigeon, since it's been 100 years since anybody was able to see one. What were they like?
They looked a lot like mourning doves. I call them in the book like mourning doves on steroids. They're about 1.5 times the size. The males had red breasts and blue-gray backs. The females were somewhat beige underneath. Probably the thing, though, that marked them most in appearance is when they aggregated in huge concentrations. Now, the birds nested by the pairs here or 10 there, 100 there, but they're best known for these breeding and roosting areas where hundreds of millions of birds would gather. And so in migration, they would form huge flights. And so, for example, John James Audubon, in traveling along the Ohio River from his home in Henderson, Kentucky, to Louisville, over the course of this three-day trip, he said the sun was eclipsed by flights of pigeons for the entire duration of the 3 days.
And this was a bird that was native to the United States.
Correct. Most of them lived in the eastern third of the United States and Canada. So it's really as much about Canada as the U.S., but those two countries.
You write in the book that when they would settle on a landscape, they could transform it.
Absolutely. Those are the kinds of things that are almost amazing. Even though these birds, you know, little, maybe 10 ounces in weight, enough of them would land in big oaks, say, and where the branches would break. And there were accounts of trees almost tipping over under the weight of these birds. There's an account from Berrien County, Michigan, not all that far to the southwest of where you are, a guy writing that the people were so afraid that their forests would be ruined that they were out there, he could hear them. They were shooting the birds all night, and he said he was weary as he had tried to do that for his own forest.
It seems as though at various times people saw them as a blessing or a curse, depending on what the pigeons were doing or when they arrived.
Sure. So, you know, the first European settlements were, you know, in New England and eastern Canada. And so one person complained. He said one year, you know, the pigeons came and ate their crops, and the pigeons were a nuisance. And then the next year they had a crop failure, and right after they determined that food would be really scarce, the pigeons arrived, and they shot the pigeons and ate them. So sometimes they were helpful to the settlers, and sometimes they were less helpful.
People ate them. Were they tasty?
They were, and varying, you know, different people had different opinions of them. Alexander Wilson, a grandfather of American ornithology, said that when pigeons are served for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for weeks at a time, then you really get sick of even the name. But some people like them. Their popularity really came down to they were cheap. I mean, they were the cheapest terrestrial protein. They could be sold for pennies apiece. But at the same time that, you know, servants and poor were eating them, They appeared on the menu of Delmonico's in New York City, arguably America's first great restaurant. It was served at some of the great banquets of the 19th century.
Native Americans and then Europeans hunted the pigeons for hundreds of years, and yet it seems from what you write as though something changed in the mid-19th century and began to accelerate the decline of the pigeon.
So one of the aspects of the pigeon, because they were moving around for food, they would often be absent from an area for years at a time. And so because they were constantly moving, you know, people hunted them, but it wasn't possible to chase them until in the 1840s, the introduction and expansion of two technologies, the railroad and the telegraph. So the railroad meant that wherever the birds showed up, I mean, in the Upper Peninsula, in the Ozarks of Missouri, even if it was in an out-of-the-way place, if you could take the dead birds that you've killed, that you've hunted, to a rail station, you put them in barrels, 300 birds to a barrel, pack it with ice, and then you could send it out to the urban markets of the Midwest and East. The telegraph meant that the whereabouts of the birds could be monitored throughout the year. In fact, telegraph operators were specifically instructed to send that information out so it could be sent out quickly and widely. And so there developed a group of hunters, anywhere from maybe 600 to 3,000, we're not sure, who did nothing but spend the entire year chasing the pigeons and killing them unceasingly throughout the seasons. And so those technologies, which facilitated communication and transportation, really started the birds into their spiral to extinction.
You say that people deployed just about every means possible to slaughter pigeons.
Some of the goofier ones, potato farmers in Ontario, if they were harvesting their crop and the birds were flying low overhead, they throw potatoes at the birds. And it's good to read that they lost more potatoes than killed passenger pigeons. But every so often, they'd knock a pigeon out of the sky and most of the stew would fall off their feet. But the two methods that were the greatest force of mortality on the birds was shooting and netting. Somebody described shooting passenger pigeons as something beyond that could not be resisted. And so they were shot, you know, for fun. They were shot for food. A flight of pigeons over a fort on the northern shores of Lake Ontario in the 1840s, bored soldiers saw the flocks fill their cannon with grape shot and fired into the flocks and, you know, watched the dead birds floating on the river, excuse me, on the lake. Netting was probably the backbone of the industry because netting is cheaper than shooting. Shooting, you have to buy ammunition and powder. So with the netting, they would use live birds as decoys, stool pigeons, and they would set up the stool pigeons would be used to attract the birds, and then they could release the netting from blinds where the hunters were hiding, and they could catch hundreds, sometimes 1,200 or 1,300 in a single release of the net.
And what happened when people started noticing, as they must have, that there weren't as many pigeons around?
You might have hoped that they would have said, gee, you know, let's be a little more circumspect in our use of them. Let's kill fewer. But the impression that I get from reading the literature is that that may have been the sentiments of a few. But most of the hunters took the different tact, and that is, this is running out. You know, we make our living doing this. We make money doing this. So we're going to kill every last bird we can. We're going to get every last penny we can out of this.
Were there attempts made to save the passenger pigeon, and when did they start?
There never was an organized attempt. I include in the book the handful of accounts I know of where individuals expressed some affection for the bird and concern for their killing. Interestingly, passenger pigeons were kind of dealt with separately. So in the 1850s, some states started passing laws to protect songbirds. Ontario specifically excluded the passenger pigeon from its songbird protection law. Ohio, in 1857, passed a small bird protection law and decided, well, what do we do about passenger pigeons? So a special committee of the state Senate was established. They deliberated, and they concluded that the pigeons were so common their numbers could never be reduced. Michigan, you'll be happy to know, it was the only state or province ever to ban all killing of passenger pigeons. That happened in 1897. That's the good news. Bad news is, by then, there weren't any birds left.
When did it become apparent to people in general that the birds were gone?
People used to, could remember when they would go out, they'd be able to fill a wagon with pigeons, or there'd be hours of a day in the spring or fall when there'd be huge clouds overhead. And so really, probably by the 1880s, 1890s, they were considering the loss. And what's interesting is a lot of people denied that the birds had disappeared. And some of that was perpetuated by this industry, which was kind of making up stories about the birds. And so there were stories that the birds had moved to Arizona or Washington State. In fact, some said they even moved down to Colombia in South America and changed their appearance so no one would find them. And then there were those like Henry Ford who said, yes, the birds are gone. Henry Ford thought that the birds all drowned in the Pacific Ocean as they were flying to freedom. So people, confronted with an inconvenient truth, we're kind of making up stuff.
In which case, it sounds like there must be a point when the denial, at least for some people, ended and there was a reckoning?
I think the reckoning would have been the passage of these laws so that we no longer in this country slaughter birds like that. There's other things we do that damage biodiversity. And that, in fact, some of those things led to the country's second great environmental movement of the 60s and 70s, Silent Spring, talking about how pesticides hurt birds and there's habitat loss and other kinds of pollution. And that led to laws, too, like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and the Endangered Species Act. So the Endangered Species Act was really a pledge that this country made that we would not allow species to become extinct, or at least not without trying hard to save them. And, the law is currently under attack. And, I'd love it if your listeners, those who care, about preserving nature, would write their lawmakers, let them know that the Endangered Species Act is really important.
Right.
There's a bird that lives in Michigan and virtually nowhere else in the world, and that's the Kirtland's warbler. That's in near Mayo and Grayling in the northern part of the southern peninsula. And that bird, it has a small range. It has really finicky habitat. We have figured out how to keep the numbers high. It requires making sure that the trees they like are of a certain height. It requires removing cowbirds, brown-headed cowbirds, which parasitate the warblers. And that costs $1 million a year. But if we spend $1 million a year, we can maintain Kirtland's warblers' numbers.
When I was finished reading the book, I couldn't help but feel a little discouraged, maybe, or a bit disgusted with people and they're having driven the pigeon to extinction. And yet, as we're talking, you're saying that some good did come of this. People did learn.
Yeah, there are. I can give you mention the Kirtland's warbler. Another bird that lives throughout Michigan is the sandhill crane. And people shouldn't take it for granted that bird now is in big numbers because, in the 1930s, that bird was also on a trajectory, if not total extinction. It was almost gone from the Midwest. We stopped shooting them, the numbers have built up. And so here in Chicago, for about a week in spring and about a week in fall, there are thousands of birds flying over. You can hear them with that wonderful trumpeting sound. So, that's a clear success. The trumpeter swan, which at one time was reduced to a few birds in the Rocky Mountains in Alaska and western Canada, has been introduced into places. And so they're now part of Michigan's avifauna as well. One final example is whales. The big whales, the blues and the rights, they were on their way to extinction, but the world agreed that wasn't a good thing, and they agreed not to kill them, and so those populations have increased. So, there are examples of success stories. And, you know, I think it's important to know about things like the passenger pigeon as kind of an inspiration of the sense to move in another direction and look at the success stories and know that better outcomes are possible.
Well, Joel Greenberg, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Joel Greenberg is the author of A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. He spoke with WMUK's Sevilla Mann. Greenberg will speak at the Kalamazoo Audubon Society on April 28th.